On This Week in Enterprise Tech, Cisco says the best way to use the Internet of Things is not to trust it. IBM says telework might be a thing of the past. And Argyle Data catches fraudsters with big data. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 241, recorded May 26, 2017, Argyle Data. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by GoCD, an on-premise open-source continuous delivery server by ThoughtWorks. GoCD gives you complete control of and visibility into your deployments across multiple teams. Since GoCD is open source, you can download it and use it for free. To discover the power of their pipelines, go to gocd.io/twit. And by Cloudflare. More than 6 million websites, apps, APIs, and SaaS companies use Cloudflare's services to weather whatever the internet throws at them. For a free online chat session with a Cloudflare support engineer, visit cloudflare.com/twit. Welcome to Twyatt This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballester, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. But of course, I cannot guide you by myself. It's an awfully big world, and I'm going to need the help of my friends, starting with Mr. Brian Chi. He is the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii. And right now, he seems to be holding up something that will get him owned. Chibert, IoT, what?
Yeah, this is new. This is actually a Avnet kit. But it's a cooperative effort between AT&T and Cisco.
Oh yeah,
for their IoT.
You know, they were pushing that at CES and Maker. What's in it?
Well, basically, it's a single board computer. Here, let's pop it open.
Chibert loves his toys. Well, I do too, to be fair.
So radio, and all kinds of stuff.
Oh, is that a LoRa radio?
No, it is cellular. It actually comes with SIMs.
Oh, very cool. Okay. All right. So you're going to be IoTing, I'm assuming, solar panels?
Something. It's basically I tinker every time I can afford it, and I'll get another platform to play with. You know, Raspberry Pis have their limitations. Arduinos have their limitations. You know, I play with a lot. By the way, I also got this, which is very cool.
What is that?
This is a USB write blocker.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we talked about that.
Okay, that's a good idea. Actually, that would have come in really handy with WannaCry.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. Well, but anyway, I'm just burning up time, so onward to the next people.
Fantastic. Of course, we've got a secondary host, as we always do, and this time it's Mr. Lou Maresca. He is a senior developer at Microsoft, although he is now the co-host formerly known as Lou because he's going to be taking on a new role at Microsoft. Lou, I know you can't talk about it yet, but at least you can smile and tell us how you're doing.
I'm doing great. It's actually sunny today and, Outlook's looking good.
Gentlemen, we've got a great show for our audience today. Not only are we going to be bringing the Twyatt Riot, our blips and our bites, but we've got Padraig Stapleton, a VP of engineering over at Argyle Data, who's going to be coming on in just a bit. But as we always do, let's kick it off with the blips. Now, we've often taken shots at the Internet of Things as a too easily ownable product category that usually fails at even the most basic security checks. Some vendors have made strides in locking down their gear, but Cisco has a different strategy. Use IoT. But don't trust it. At the IoT World Forum in London this past week, Cisco revealed their IoT Threat Defense Suite. It combines 7 products to provide connectivity, analytics, and security for the Internet of Things. At the core of the suite is a piece of wisdom that we at Twit have been preaching for more than 2 years. You can't trust IoT devices to be secure. Instead, Cisco's solution is to secure the IoT by mitigating its eventual exploitation. In Cisco's scheme, IoT devices are isolated and segmented by the Cisco TrustSec platform. Those segments are watched by Cisco Stealth Watch, and if ownage is detected, Cisco Threat Defense can identify the infected host and block those segments automatically before they can be used as a pivot point to penetrate deeper into the network or to be used as part of a botnet. These aren't new tools, but bundling them with a focus on IoT is a great move beyond perimeter security and into proactive defense that might just save the Internet of Things.
WannaCry is at the tip of every tech person's tongue, including Windows 7 users who had the bulk of the effects. Windows 95 and Windows 98 users are no strangers to the blue screen of death. If WannaCry wasn't enough, a new bug has been discovered that actually can crash or blue screen Windows 7 and Windows 8 users just by having an oddly named file name from a website. On Windows 7 PC, with a default install of Internet Explorer, if a website has an image file named, say, $MFT, it actually causes performance to degrade and sometimes hang and ultimately can crash a machine. Well, the question is, why could that happen? Well, the $MFT is a name for a file that is given from a special metadata files in Windows 7 and 8 for the NTFS file system. And the file exists in the root directory of each NTFS volume, but the NTFS driver handles it in a special way, and it's hidden away from accessibility and other software. Since the file system actually takes a lock on the file, it makes it hard for any other process to access it, say Internet Explorer, maybe even Windows Explorer. And even though this isn't malicious in nature, it can actually be exploited to allow for remote file execution, since systems are vulnerable when they're made to crash. Microsoft has been informed about the issue, and no additional data or timeline has been available. Is there a workaround? Well, for the time being, you could block the machines from downloading files with similar names, preventing this issue from happening to you. If nothing else, it's a good gap filler until the OS is fixed.
While securing IoT with the Microsoft Research Project called SOPRIS. The Microsoft Research Project SOPRIS team invites the security research community to test our most recent experiment, the SOPRIS Security Kit, by applying the Project SOPRIS Challenge. The primary goal of the challenge is to broadly engage with the security community towards sharing and learning. 150 security experts have been selected to receive and test the SOPRIS Security Kit through the challenge. The application period closed at midnight on April 14th Pacific Daylight Time. Applicants have been notified if they are accepted to participate in the challenge by email by April 21st. Devices have been distributed by early May with the challenge ending on July 12th. It is free to participate and there are no fees for the hardware. In my opinion, this is a darn great way to test your IoT platform. Too often security is an afterthought for IoT designers, but if the base platform itself is tested this rigorously, we may have a fighting chance at preventing huge DDoS attacks from shabbily built IoT devices. Hopefully we'll see a presentation at Black Hat, if I can ever get permission to go, darn it. But I sure hope so.
Now, there has been a lot of talk about the proper way to promote investments by U.S. corporations and enterprises, with a lot of partisan bickering going back and forth. Well, we're not going to get dragged into that. Instead, we're going to ask the question, if corporations and enterprises had the money to invest, what would they invest in? An article from Reuters brings the problem into sharp focus by looking at upgrade cycles in America's industrial and IT infrastructure, and the results aren't exactly encouraging. An in-depth look at factories and enterprises across the country show a singular trend. There's no pressing need to change equipment and processes that are currently working. The highlighted examples include a factory in Cleveland with a 50-ton press from the 50s that is still in production today. A factory in California that bought an assembly line from the 80s for $140,000 rather than paying $3 million for a new one. And most importantly for us, network and client-side upgrade cycles that have gone from 2 years in the early 2000s to over 5 years today. The fact of the matter is that equipment we built might be too good, and the efficiencies that we've won from the use of shared infrastructure might be too efficient for the old priming the pump adage to apply. In other words, the enterprise today has learned to be more frugal, and no investment promotion strategy from either side of the aisle will work without taking that into account.
So there's this new thing, it's called integration as a service, and it's with plus big data seems to be a trend for a lot of the new startups out there. Lots of new companies are finding ways to bind data from multiple sources, bring it together and analyze it and develop insights into it. An Israeli company named Hexadite is no exception to this rule. Hexadite focuses on cybersecurity, and their technology connects existing cybersecurity detection systems and their data together, providing an even smarter detection heuristic. Hexadite raised about an $8 million Series A round fund last year from Hewlett-Packard, as well as 10 11 Ventures and YL Ventures, adding in about $2 million in seed funding. It seems that there is a possible interest from Microsoft coming down the pipe. A local business publication in Israel called Calculist is reporting that Microsoft is in the process of acquiring Hexadite for a sum of close to $100 million. The publication has a good track record, but so does Microsoft's trend of acquiring cybersecurity firms. Back in 2015, Microsoft bought Israeli-based Secure Islands this past January and invested in an Israeli cybersecurity firm Team8. And just last month, there was reports of an acquisition of Israeli cloud monitoring startup Cloudin for about $60 million. This new report holds water since Microsoft continues to double down on its battle against cybersecurity. For Hexadite's case and its investors, let's hope it's true.
Patent trolls get slammed by the U.S. Supreme Court landmark ruling. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled earlier this week on how to interpret patent venue laws and may have struck down the East Texas rampage by patent trolls. The ARS technical story follows the start from the 1948 patent venue law, where a lawsuit filing can be done where a defendant resides or is doing business. Later modified in the 1956 decision, Transmira Products versus Forco Glass, where the stricter rule of U.S. Code 28, Section 1400, is the sole and exclusive provision controlling venue for patent infringement cases. Next, we had a 1990 ruling called VE Holding versus Johnson Gas Appliance in Federal Circuit Court about moving its case to Indiana. What this week's decision basically means is that the VE Holding decision was a big mistake. The ruling as such is, the only question we must answer is whether Congress changed the meaning of Section 1400B, aka the patent venue law, when it amended Section 1391, the general venue law. When Congress intends to effect a change of this kind, it ordinarily provides a relatively clear indication of its intent in the text of the amended provision. The current version of Section 1391 does not contain any indication that Congress intended to alter the meaning of Section 1400B as interpreted in Forco. Got that? So the patent venue question has had a long road from the 1948 decision, modified in 1956, mangled in 1990, and finally corrected this week. Well, the cogs of justice seemingly are working, but oh my God, it's taken a long time to get it right.
Oh, back in March, FCC regulations that would have required ISPs to get your permission before selling your personal data to third parties was overturned by a bill mostly authored by Republican U.S. Representative Marsha Blackburn. The justification at the time was that regulations hurt innovation and customer choice. It wasn't really a surprise, as the GOP representatives of the FCC had been promising exactly that since the regulations were passed, which is why it was more than a little surprising when last week the same Marsha Blackburn proposed a new law that would, wait for it, require ISPs to get your permission before selling your personal data to third parties. Now, her bill does have a few differences. First, it applies to all entities on the internet, not just ISPs. Secondly, it places the regulatory burden on the FTC and not the FCC. And third, and most importantly, it would bar states from enacting their own privacy laws. That last tidbit could explain what seems to be an about-face. Blackburn, who is the top recipient of telco donations at more than $500,000, is feeling the heat both from her constituents who feel betrayed by her repeal of the FCC regulations and by her benefactors who have been anxiously watching more and more states work towards enacting their own privacy protections. No matter the case, unless the bill is also accompanied by a massive increase of manpower at the FTC, expect this to be just a symbolic gesture. That does it for the Blips. Next up, we've got the Bites, but first let's go ahead and take a moment to thank a sponsor of this week in Enterprise Tech. Now, Twilight Riot, this episode is brought to you by GoCD. GoCD is an on-premise, open-source, continuous delivery server created by ThoughtWorks. Now, with GoCD's comprehensive pipeline modeling, you can model complex workflows across multiple teams with ease. It can easily configure dependencies for fast feedback and on-demand deployment with its parallel and sequential execution. What it means is that it gives you complete transparency into what your deployments are doing. It offers complete customization for your software's individual needs, and its real power is that it gives you power over your end-to-end workflow. So you get complete control of and visibility into all of your deployments across the organization. GoCD also supports audible deployments and can delegate the configuration of pipelines to users without full-blown admin privileges. It will perform tests written in most languages or frameworks, and unlike other products, their test reporting is so detailed that it will tell you exactly in which chain set and on which platform a test started to break. That means that you can compare content across any two arbitrary builds, making it invaluable when troubleshooting a broken pipeline. GoCD also has extension points for which plugins can be created, or you could use any of the numerous plugins that are already available. You can say goodbye to deployment panic and hello to consistent, predictable deliveries. Folks, we want you to work smarter, not harder. That's why we're recommending GoCD for the Twilight Riot. GoCD is an open source solution that you can download and use for free. Discover the power of their pipelines at gocd.io/twit. That's gocd.io/twit. Commercial support and enterprise add-ons, including disaster recovery, are also available. And we thank GoCD for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Gentlemen, let's go ahead and move on to the bites. This one is it's a little bit fun. We all heard about WannaCry. We've seen it spread across the globe. We've seen the mainstream media kind of understand it, kind of get it. And now there's a little bit of hope that comes to us from some researchers who took a look at the not-so-great source code of WannaCry and figured out a way that there might be for you to get your data back. Now, Cheever, this is kind of fun because we played with this on KnowHow. We had two researchers, one who created what was called WannaKey, which was designed for XP machines, and then another researcher who created WannaKiwi, which was designed for Windows XP 7 and on up. Now, the whole idea is that they take advantage of, I'm going to call it a sloppy code in the WannaCry Trojan. Now, when WannaCry runs, what it does is it takes two random prime numbers, multiplies them together, and then it creates public and private keys. It then deletes the private key so that you have to get that from the ransomware in order to unlock and decrypt your files. Well, unfortunately, they never wrote code that would clear the memory of the process created within Windows, because Windows, it sets aside a bit of memory. So what these researchers did was, if you can get into the system fast enough and run their software, either WannaKey or WannaKiwi, it will look through that memory, find two primes, and then reconstruct the private key. Now, it's absolutely brilliant. And the wonderful thing is they've put up their code on GitHub, so you can actually download it and see exactly what it's doing. It's quite an interesting case study. But here's the thing. There's not a great success rate. It does work. And in theory, it is a great, great process. But you have to get very, very lucky. First of all, you can't have rebooted, because if you reboot your computer or shut it down, you lose everything in volatile memory. Those primes are gone. Secondly, you have to hope that the process itself hasn't written to any of its memory cells between the time that it encrypts and the time that you run WannaKey or WannaKiwi. And the third thing is that you better hope that you have a copy of WannaKiwi with you already on the computer, because any sort of action in the operating system could potentially overwrite those memory logs. Now, Cheebert, this we've been talking about WannaCry on KnowHow for the past 2 weeks. It's really not an elegant solution. I mean, it works. It has infected a lot of people. By all accounts, they've probably gotten about $95,000 in bitcoins by now, which is not huge. It's not great for that many infections. But this sort of sloppy software is what we expect out of people who are just using something like Metasploit, right? This is a security toolkit that they slapped together a couple of 0 days on and sent it out into the world.
Yeah. I hesitate to use the label script kiddie, but it does kind of feel like it. You know, it's anyone that has actually taken a good course or actually studied how encryption is supposed to work, they've kind of ignored a couple of the real basics. I know it sounds like, you know, backseat driver, you know, Sunday afternoon quarterback and all that stuff. But realistically, it's like, gee, come on. You know, I don't want people to write better worms and viruses and things like that. And I totally and completely applaud these guys for being able to have a utility to be able to go and take advantage of this weakness. But this was the press has been going crazy only because I don't think they understand it. This was more social engineering.
Yeah. The strange thing about this is we've had crypto ransomware for years now, and we've had actually far more disruptive crypto ransomware. This sort of caught the imagination of the traditional non-techie media because of the impact, because there were so many machines in the UK, China, Russia that were connected to things like hospitals and factories that it seemed like this was different. But I mean, in terms of payout, it's definitely not the largest crypto ransomware ever to hit. And in terms of sophistication, it about the only thing it has going for it is that it included two NSA exploits. It included Eternal Blue and then the Double Pulsar backdoor.
It's got a catchy name. It used some things from an agency that everybody now loves to hate because of all the things that have been released. And it made headlines. It's that old saying, if it bleeds, it leads. I'm sorry. This is mainstream media milking it for all it's worth so they can sell page clicks and things like that. And their experts have been saying, this isn't really that sophisticated. We've had better exploits in the past. But mainstream media is dying. They need something to go and sell papers, so to speak.
Right. We've got JJ to the 4884 in the chat room is saying, could this lead to a migration to Linux? And I'm just going to flat out say no. Anyone who was using a system that could be infected by WannaCry is still going to be using that system. They'll just be using a backup copy. At issue is the fact that, for example, the factories and the hospitals that made this a big story, the reason why they were running Windows was because they have legacy applications that only run on those older, more easily infected versions of Windows. So absolutely, they're not going to move to Linux. In fact, if they were going to migrate, they were going to migrate to a more secure version of Windows because it'll be easy for them to get their infrastructure back up. The second thing about this is you got to remember, Linux boxes had a really hard time with crypto ransomware as well. There are several variants out there that affect Android phones on older operating systems, and even Linux-embedded boxes like NAS devices have been hit by crypto ransomware. So this is not a Windows thing. This is just if you can find an exploit that runs a remote execution, you can run crypto ransomware. Lou, let me talk to you about this, because one of the things that we brought up in know-how was this idea of using micro VMs, how everything should be sandboxed, so that even if you have a bad outcome, when the sandbox disappears, the bad outcome disappears as well. We saw this at VMworld. We saw this at the Intel Developer Forum. We saw this at CES. Are we there? I know Microsoft has been making strides in allowing VMs to run inside Windows 10. Are we getting to a time where every process, not just browsing, but every process just runs in its own micro VM or container?
I wish that was the case. I think, it's actually a misconception that running code, isolated code in VM, like running viruses in a VM to test them out or so on, doesn't leak outside the VM. It's actually a misconception. I've seen where VMs still store data on your disk, and even though you run some kind of code or malicious things inside the VM, you think it's isolated. It's not fully isolated from your hosting operating system. So it's actually a misconception. But containers are a different story. So they kind of isolate at the hardware level. And I think that, yes, I think that the scalability and capability of doing that to be able to resource unused resources within a particular machine for particular containers in an isolation or isolated way will allow for cloud services to scale more, will allow for a better isolation models and sandboxes, as well as it'll allow for better utilization of the resources of that machine. So I do think that is the next wave of the future, but be careful when you try to test things on VMs.
Right. And actually, funny fact here, people kept asking me why I actually brought in physical hardware for know-how rather than running everything in VM. And there was two reasons. One, some malware that I've been playing with actually reacts to VMs. It's become VM aware. It knows if it's running in a sandbox, and it doesn't do the behavior that allows you to identify it. The second thing is I wasn't about to rip out my VMware cluster from my data closet to bring it into the studio. So there you go. Now, Cheebert, Same question to you. We've heard since the start of TWiET about the use of different virtualized technologies in order to make sure that things run safely. 5 years later, I don't feel as if we've made great strides. I mean, there's a lot of promise, but it always seems as if there's a lot of promise, but nothing actually happening. When do we move to a point where the operating system is completely protected from attacks like this?
Never.
Okay.
That's good. The bottom line. You know,
that was the right answer.
Yeah. The problem is you can make a secure operating system. No problem. That's easy. It's just unusable.
All right.
You know, that's the bottom line.
You know, the funny thing is some of the data is now starting to trickle out because we've heard a lot of the general data about WannaCry. 200,000 to 400,000 systems, depending on how you count it. About 90,000 worth of Bitcoin is what they've been able to get from their victims, which, again, is not much. It's like one in every 2,000 people who's been infected. And we know that now what we assumed was going to be mostly an XP infection is not. Chibert, you actually did a little bit of reading on this. The data that we're getting back, at least in the United States, is that by far the most infected platform was not Windows XP. It was Windows 7.
Yeah, something like 97% is what I seem to be getting.
Right, right. And I think that has to do with, and this was from the Microsoft brief, that XP can be infected, but it cannot share the infection over Samba. Windows 7 can be infected, and it can share the infection over a Samba share. So remember, the WannaCry is really three packages. It's a Trojan, it's a worm, and then it's a backdoor. So the Trojan works on all versions of Windows. The backdoor will work on any version of Windows that it gets installed on, but the SMB exploit, will only work on Windows 7 and Windows Vista machines. It does not work on 10, does not work on XP, does not work on 2000. I got to ask, Lou, I don't know if you have any insight into this, because I know you're not on the operating system side of Microsoft, but why is that? Like, for example, Windows 10 did have the Samba exploit in it before it was patched, but even that version of Windows 10 cannot be infected over the network.
So different versions of different operating systems have different ways that they actually institute or handle protocols. And so, you know, obviously Windows 10 being the most secure of the operating systems, they handle different process isolations and then protocol isolations. So that's why they handle it differently. Now, why it was still on Windows 10? Well, because of backwards compatibility. Microsoft's known for their backwards compatibility, especially with operating system and executables and processes and so on and services. So I think that that's one of the reasons why it was still enabled but again, it was isolated more so in that area. You know, I also wanted to comment something on the side of the severity of this. So I think, you know, I've seen a lot of articles around town, around the internet about talking about, oh, it's not as serious as we thought it was going to be. Well, you know, when you can put a machine on the internet and within seconds it can be detected and actually infected, it's a scary thing. And I think that don't not take that seriously, because I have privy to information of many, many organizations and global companies being affected by this thing at a much bigger scale and having to pull the plug on their data centers because of it. And so I think we want to make sure that you guys are taking it seriously and don't read silly dribble articles that say it's not.
Right, right. Yeah, this is an issue just because it's not going to go away. If not WannaCry, we already know that there's a variant out there that doesn't use two NSA exploit packages. It uses 7. So they're going to get more and more sophisticated because the tools to assemble these modules are becoming easier and easier to use. A last few words before we have to move on. I will say this. I've spent a lot of time in my lab with WannaCry. I've had XP, Vista, 10, and 2000 machines running. And then I ran a single Windows 7 machine with WannaCry and just let it sit in the middle of the network. It was fascinating because I didn't see the infection spread except for one instance. But what I did see on the Vista machine was the anti-malware software that came with Vista, and it's an unpatched version of Vista, suddenly went haywire. So it actually did recognize that something was trying to run. It just didn't let it. So I'd love to spend more time. Again, I'm not a security researcher, so I can't dive too deep, but it is interesting to see the behavior. The other thing you're going to want to do here is make sure you have the WannaKiwi already on your system, because, again, you're your window of opportunity is very, very slim. I ran the infection 10 times on 10 different machines, and I was only able to decrypt twice. In fact, I spent most of last night trying to make it work again so I could demo it on new screensavers, and it just never came back. All right, so let's go ahead and move on. Oh, and by the way, if you do want to see more about WannaCry, you need to check out episodes 313 and 314. 312 and 314 of Know How at twit.tv/KH. You can actually see us do the infection live and try to do a decryption live. So, and that's what it looks like when your TriCaster gets infected with WannaCry. It just starts deleting people. It's very sad. Very sad. Well, next up, we've got this. IBM reverses an old telework trend. Now, T-Bert, we're old enough to remember when there was a time where work meant you had to come into the office. You had to be seen by your supervisor. You had to be in your cubicle on time. Maybe you even had to punch in. And then when you left, you would punch out or you would be seen by your manager leaving. And that was considered work time. Well, in our lifetimes, that started to change. There was this telework, this idea of working from home, if not every day, at least a couple of days a week, that it could potentially increase productivity. But you've got a story about how IBM has decided that's bunk. Tell me about it.
Well, it basically comes out to there's reversing a trend. It was actually to a point where IBM employees, when they actually did need an office, could walk into an office to any empty cubicle, type in a code on the telephone system, and their IBM extension number, wherever they worked in the IBM network, would be routed to them. It was part of this golden promise of being able to use less office space and higher productivity. And it was a trend that a lot of people wanted to follow. In fact, I know a lot of places that went to hot desking and then didn't. And then, gee, it's great. It's a wonderful, wonderful benefit, especially for moms and dads that have a sick kid or whatever. Being able to work from home is a pretty nice thing. I've tried working from home. I'm not very productive. The allure of working in your jammies is kind of cool, but I think I've come to the same conclusion IBM did. Now, having said all that, I've been talking to a whole bunch of people in some business sites, and the comments have been, gee, you know, we've seen this coming a long time, but this might not be what we thought it was. This might be IBM's way of reducing their workforce. Some people are saying as high as 40%. Some people are saying now it's probably close to 20%. But it's a way to reduce their workforce without taking a hit on the stock market, because it's not a layoff. It's people deciding they don't want to work from home anymore, and Wall Street is reacting differently to this. Is it a stealth layoff? Or is it a end of a trend? Or is it both? I think it's both.
It's interesting because, and Lou, I want to get your input on this. When teleworking was being sold to us, because again, are you young enough to remember a time before teleworking was even a thing?
What's that?
Kevin, I'm not asking you because I know that you were not alive at that point because you're like 12 years old. No, but Lou, you were alive before at that time, right?
Yeah.
Like when you
Absolutely.
First entered the market.
I remember the days when my dad used to have the suitcase computer he used to walk around with the phone on it. Then before those days, I remember those days.
But one of the reasons why they were able to sell this was just not that it would be a benefit to the employee. There were several studies, very interesting studies, that said you actually increase productivity. When people can spend at least a couple of days at home, they're more refreshed. They don't burn out as quickly. Well, we've seen the likes of Google and Yahoo and to a certain extent, even Microsoft kind of pull back on that and say, this was nice, but we're actually seeing a productivity drop off. Does this invalidate the experiment? As T-Bert said, he knows for him, teleworking doesn't work. For me, it's a little bit different because I've actually created a space that I know when I'm in that space, it's a workspace. Others haven't done that. People think they can telework at the local Starbucks, which doesn't really work all that well. What's your call, Lou?
You know, I think it all depends on, there's two things. It all depends on the person. That's the first thing. And, you know, I'm definitely not as productive as home because I have kids and they will come into my office no matter if I try to lock it or not. That's the one thing. But the second thing is, I'm going to tell you one thing, is Microsoft is definitely not downplaying remote. I know a lot of people who work remotely. Some of the best people, best engineers and best PMs that I know actually work remotely. You probably know some of them. And another thing too is, the interesting thing is, I kind of agree with Cheever, is, you know, IBM actually published a white paper back in 2014 about their smarter workplace, from their Smarter Workplace Institute, that basically said that experts say that people are happier, more productive, and more engaged with their jobs and teams when they work remotely. So it's almost they're basically taking a renege on that, and they're saying, hey, we decided that this is not the case. I do think it's due to a business need and potentially a change in management. A management changed and some views in those management say, I don't like it when people are not here. I want them in here. So I almost like, I think it's people are making a big deal out of this rather than out of really nothing, I guess you could say. Is it saying that people are just less productive remotely? I don't think so. I think that there are many people in the world that are very productive remotely. I have developers and engineers that work remotely that don't work in this office that are the most productive people that I know. So I'm definitely going to say that I think that this is just dribble and thrown out of proportion. But I do actually agree with Cheebert saying that, hey, this could be a business thing. It could be a way to, again, downsize or just somebody, some manager, some leader is pissed off and doesn't like that, and they decided to change the culture. And I think that happens a lot.
Yeah. The sad side is I've heard this from both sides. Yes, I believe both of you have very good points. It depends on the person. So there are certain people that can get away with working from home. They actually have the ability to sort of turn off all the distractions and be very productive. Secondly, there are certain jobs that lend themselves to teleworking. You can't really be a manager and telework. That doesn't work. You have to be there. But beyond the individual person that they're selecting for teleworking, it's also the workplace. And Lou, you can back me up on this. There are very good managers who actually take time to communicate with their workers, whether or not they're in the office, who can, from that, decide whether or not a worker is being productive. And I've also met managers who, unless they actually see their workers at their desks in front of them, they just assume that they're not doing the job. You know, so to paint everyone with the same brush and say either it does work or it doesn't work, not super effective. Yeah, would you agree, Chubert?
I definitely agree.
Yeah, Lou, we'll come back to you.
No, it's okay. I think I definitely like for instance, I'll give you an example. Scott Hanselman, who's like one of the top PMs in Azure, he works remotely. He works from Portland, but he's one of the most productive people that I know. Every little second has to be accounted for him. And you know, but again, it depends on the person. But going back to the management question, I think that there are people that, especially good managers, can tell the difference. Like, for instance, I know people who can say, hey, I'm working from home, but when they don't answer emails or they don't answer IM or I don't see any commits or PRs from them over a good 24 hours, you know that they're not really working from home. And you have sometimes have a discussion with them saying, hey, I need you to be productive if you're going to work from home or not. I've had that discussion before. So I think that, you know, if you're paying attention, you will know, hey, this person, they're attending meetings, they're on the call, they're in the Skype meeting, they're producing emails, they're responding quickly, they're doing their normal daily things, but they're doing it from there. And I think that's the best way to tell.
On a personal note, I will say that if I'm in the studio, it means I'm not working. Cheebert?
Well, I have one last thing to say, though. One thing you got to separate is there's working from home and working remotely. Because 100% of my job, well, let's call it 90% of my job, is on my laptop. I'm just as productive remotely that I am at the office. The difference is home has more distractions. And so, yeah, unless you've got a space carved off, it's less productive, at least for me.
Yeah, I'm sort of the same way. I've tried working from home in several different environments, and it only works if I have a place that I know is my workspace while I'm at home. And if the people I'm living with understand that during work hours, it's work hours. I'm not available for anything else. All right. Well, gentlemen, let's go ahead and move on. In just a bit, we're going to be bringing in a guest. That's right, my favorite part of This Week in Enterprise Tech. We've got Padraig Stapleton. He is the VP of Engineering over at Argyle Data. If you want to know how you're going to be analyzing your big data, your data in the future, you're going to want to stay tabbed. But first, let's go ahead and take a moment to thank another sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, this episode of TWiET is brought to you by Cloudflare. Yeah, you know Cloudflare. That's right. The big iron, the protection that the internet needs. Cloudflare is on a mission to build a better internet. They make your site or app faster, safer, and more reliable so that you can stop worrying about how slow they load. You can stop worrying about downtime. You can stop worrying about getting hacked. Cloudflare is incredibly easy to use, and sign up takes less than 5 minutes. They've got a global network of 115-plus data centers that cache your content and move it closer to your visitors. And their web optimization feature speeds up your code and makes it mobile responsive. Now, end-to-end, Cloudflare speeds up every request to your site with performant DNS, caching, content optimization, load balancing, and more. It also makes your site, app, or API more secure because Cloudflare doesn't only provide DDoS protection. We know that's why they're famous. That's what where they made their bones. But their web application firewall is powered by a massive IP reputation feature that updates for all users. The 24/7 security team is constantly watching for new vulnerabilities and deploying real-time protection, and they do it across their network, which means that when one customer, one user experiences an attack, a problem, that mitigation strategy can be applied to the entire network of protection. You could also avoid cloud provider lock-in. This is something that's important. If you've ever bought into a provider, into a cloud service, and then realize that there was no easy and inexpensive way to move your content, to move your app, to move your API from one provider to the next, well, then you're going to love Cloudflare because Cloudflare doesn't do that. No matter what you choose for your cloud compute, AWS, Azure, Google Cloud, a combination of public or private, Cloudflare will work with all of them. Using Cloudflare gives your business the option to use more than one cloud provider so you don't get locked in. Now, it also provides flat pricing for everyone. If you're hit with a DDoS attack or if your site suddenly experiences a surge in legitimate traffic, you might be afraid of what it might do to your bill. Well, with Cloudflare, don't be, because you're always going to pay the same amount. The plans range from free, $20 a month, $200 a month, and custom plans for enterprise. Now, Cloudflare is offering TWiT listeners a free online chat session with one of their top support engineers to answer any of your questions and see if Cloudflare is right for you. Visit cloudflare.com/twit to sign up today. That's cloudflare.com/twit. And we thank Cloudflare for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my favorite time of the show when we ask a guest to come in and drop knowledge on the TWiET Right. And today we have brought you a special something. Mr. Padraig Stapleton is the VP of Engineering at Argyle Data. Padraig, thank you very much for joining us on This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Thank you for having me.
Now, for the folks at home, what exactly is Argyle Data?
So Argyle Data is a company that's focused on building applications on top of big data and leverage machine learning basically for all the analytics upon the data that's ingested into the platform. So our premise from the get-go was we wanted to build an application with a real ROI and a real use case for the customers. And our initial focus is on the telco space. So we built a fraud application for the telco carriers. We built it based on big data and machine learning technology. And we built it with a view of making it future-proof, thinking about the challenges that carriers are going to have over the next 5 to 10 years. So what that means is you need to be able to deal with extreme volumes of data. Mobile carriers and carriers in general are one of the few verticals that have real big data. Their volumes are just huge. On a daily basis, we're looking at billions of events, and you need a platform to be able to process those events in real time. Secondly, we took the premise that with that amount of data, you really cannot rely on manual analysis or manual intervention to understand what's happening within your network. You need to leverage the power of computing and more so the power of machine learning algorithms to be able to tell you what's happening within your network from a perspective of fraud, security, and other types of anomalous behavior that's happening within your network. So we built a platform. We leveraged the best of breed components in the Hadoop ecosystem. We built our application on top of it. And that application is primarily focused on ingesting data at real time, either from IP streams, signaling IP traffic in a carrier's network, back-end file systems, etc., pushing that through a real-time streaming process, doing a bunch of modifications on it, streaming it, featureizing it, preparing it for the machine learning algorithms, pushing it through machine learning in real time, and then providing insights to our customers.
Well, Parag, one of the things I think Argyle Data has done exceptionally well is they're not just a big data company. There's a lot of big data companies out there that promote the technology behind it and the hardware behind it. Well, what Argyle did was you actually built a use case. You went to the telcos and it was not, hey, you should do something with all that data you have. It was, this is the insight we can give you with the data that you're getting. And as you mentioned, there's a lot of data, but what's the actionable analytics that Argyle can actually provide?
So it's it depends on the use case. So to your point, we really set out to provide value to our end customer rather than a set of tools and then tell them, hey, here you are, you go figure it out. We wanted to do the heavy lifting for them. So the types of insight and analytics. So if we think about network fraud is a big problem for carriers. It's a $9 billion plus problem every year. So by actually looking at their data and applying machine learning and combining the different data sets within the carrier's world, we're able to detect fraud that's happening across the network, do it faster, and do it with a lot more accuracy. And, you know, our marketing VP has a catchword that minutes means millions. So obviously the speed of capture and detection of fraud is crucial for the mobile carriers. So that's one example of a real insight that actually helps them save money. Another area that's a really interesting and getting a lot of interest in across the mobile carriers globally is what's a problem called subscription fraud, particularly around NeverPay. NeverPay is when people use false information and basically use that to go to a carrier's online store, go to the retail store, etc., trying to acquire a iPhone or a Samsung. I mean, the mobile industry is one of the most interesting industries where if I go to Best Buy and I go to buy a HD TV, they will require me to pay the full price of that TV before I walk out the door with it under my arm. In the mobile industry, the model is a little bit differently. I go to the store. I can get out of the store with a very nice computer called an iPhone or a Samsung Galaxy worth $700 to $800, et cetera, for maybe a down deposit of $100. And a lot of folks have figured out that there's a great arbitrage there. If I can convince the carrier to make that available to me and I can figure out a way to disappear, I can go sell that overseas. So that's an area where we've actually done a lot of work, basically tapping into the data that's made available when folks are trying to acquire those phones, combining that with back-end data that carriers have, maybe subscription information, CDR information, et cetera. And by running all those different data sets through models, we're able to actually help them, you know, identify potential fraudsters, high-risk applicants at that stage, and basically cut down severely the amount of losses they're having from those very nice computers disappearing into the ether in the black market.
Let me ask you about that, because I'm fascinated by this. Someone in the industry told me that they're not really concerned about the one-off fraudster. And the one-off fraudster did something stupid. What they're concerned about, and what you're talking about, is the systematic defrauding of the system. When they realize they found something that's not really watched closely and they can hit it again and again and again. They can go from store to store to store, carrier to carrier to carrier. If you have a big data system, that's what it watches for, right? It's not looking for the individual cases of fraud. It's looking for the cases of fraud that have a pattern and are done again and again and again.
That's exactly what we see, right? Your point. I mean, no one's going to make a living out of stealing one iPhone. However, people make a pretty good living out of stealing hundreds or thousands of phones. And what we've seen across the board is, fraudsters are always probing. They're probing at a number of levels. They're probing at a carrier level to see which carriers have the best systems and processes in place to try and detect these problems. And then actually, if they figure out that there's opportunity within a carrier, Then they go, okay, where about in the carrier's network is the best and easiest way to fraud? Is it through their own stores or is it through the third-party agents that are also selling their service and handsets? So what you find is that once they hone in on a particular area, it could be a store, it could be a third-party agent, they just keep hammering it. And they keep going back and back. Once they figure out a way to, you know, exploit a weakness within the processes in the carrier, they will keep replicating it. I mean, that we have stories where people like they're driving folks around vans in one of the carrier's customers, and they know how to basically set up the process for information to provide and what will get checked. They also know the internal processes of the carrier so that they can time the window just right. They know that the carrier's internal teams are under a time crunch to have all the reviews done by a certain time in order to push it to the next phase. And if they don't have enough time, they'll just approve it and carrier ends up being out of pocket. So yeah, these folks are really good at basically studying the processes carriers have and then determining where the weakness is. And that's where big data helps, because we can handle the volumes of data that come in. We can look for patterns across all the different stores, all the different channels that a carrier has, and be able to detect basically anomalous fraudulent activity before it gets out of hand.
I find that absolutely fascinating. I can conceptualize what that's like. I understand what you're doing, but is there any chance you could break us down even further? So what are the things, what are the metrics, the measurables that you get, that you analyze, that point towards frauds? I mean, of course, it's going to change. It's always going to change. This is a cat and a mouse game. But let's get theoretical here for a second.
Yeah.
If I'm a fraudster, what are the things that I'm doing that you're going to start to be able to detect?
Yeah, so there's a few things. So, you know, when you come to a carrier's store, online channel, etc., you're going to have to provide a certain amount of information. You'll provide information around who you are, name, address, if you're a house owner, depending on the part of the world you're in, you know, if you're employed, unemployed, how long you've been resident in a particular address, and maybe some bank details. So that's one set of application information. Then there's another set of information we get. It's like, okay, what type of phone are you buying? What type of plan are you trying to acquire? Where are you trying to acquire it? Are you acquiring it through a carrier store? And then what about the agents in the store? Who are you dealing with in that store, et cetera? And the same information for third parties. So we're actually taking in all that information. And what we actually find is that you will find patterns around the information that's being provided by fraudsters that will kind of, it's a tell. And that's the tell that we're looking for in the big data. We also combine that information with CDR data. So, you know, if we see a number that someone's trying to port in, we will look at, in some parts of the world, we'll look at the history of calls related to that number. And, you know, there's a little bit of social network analysis going on here that allows us to kind of infer whether that particular user might actually have been in contact, or the types of folks that they're calling, receiving calls from, et cetera, on a regular basis, maybe, we'll say, less creditworthy than other parts. And, you know, there are restrictions in certain parts of the world. You can do this kind of profiling and others not. And obviously, that's one of the things you have to take into account. But it's this information is what we actually apply to a number of machine learning algorithms. And that, again, it's, we can pick out from that data both the what we call the features, which is the information we get, and then a series of synthetic features, which is kind of features that we derive from that basic information that we're getting from the carrier and their back end, and their customer system. That's what allows us to actually detect fraud and be able to give them, and it's a score, right? I mean, you can never say 100% that this person's a fraudster, but what you're telling them is that we think there's a high probability that there is a risk of fraud is going to happen with this particular applicant who's trying to acquire an iPhone or a handset. And what we've seen, I mean, there's a few really interesting stuff. You'll find that fraud sometimes has is very localized. If they find a particular store where, well, for whatever reason, those guys are trying to earn a lot of commission, or the processes in the store or the people in the store are not very diligent, they will keep going back to that store. And big data allows us to find that very quickly and actually help a carrier eliminate it. Other types of things that are actually really interesting is, you know, in some parts of the world, what the fraudsters were doing was they were actually looking at houses for sale, and they were providing addresses which were valid, but it turned out they were empty residences. And so they would get the phones shipped to the residences. and they would turn up at those residences to collect the phones. So you had to actually start looking at additional data sources to be able to determine whether this was a valid use case, a valid customer or not. So there's a lot of different things you need to look at in order to provide a really robust protection for the carriers in this space.
And the thing that enables this is the fact that Argyle is doing this data analytics live. You're doing it in real time. This is not one of those solutions that we would see in an academic environment where you collect a lot of big data, multiple terabytes of big data, and then you analyze it post-fact. This is Argyle data analyzing terabytes of data in real time. And that's what allows this to be a proactive rather than reactive system.
That is correct. So when you're at the store and you're providing the information, we either through a REST API or through dropping a pixel, we're getting that information. And we literally have to do the analysis, run it through the machine learning, and provide that score back to the system within seconds, because they want to be able to provide some indication while the person is in the store or while they're in the online browser as to whether they want to accept the application, and then if they do, what level of deposit they might want to request in order to approve it subsequently. So yes, it's all real time, and therein lies the challenge, right? It's the ability to take in that data at volume, at scale, and then push it through machine learning and get the answer back in literally seconds, so that they can continue to go about their business.
And what can you tell me a little bit about the technology that Argyle is using? This is not a simple feat. I mean, this is a lot of data crunching from multiple sources. It's not an off-the-shelf solution. What has Argyle done to enable this?
Yeah, there's a lot of things. So, I mean, primarily we're leveraging leveraging Hadoop open source. So, you know, the distributions from folks like Cloudera, Hortonworks, but the packages that exist within that. So we leverage technology such as Flume. We do a lot of work with Kafka Streams. We're finding that is really good for both scaling and for real-time streaming of information. And also from the perspective that we can do a lot of kind of upfront aggregation, featureization of the data as we push it through the streaming process. And the other interesting thing here is that I will say that it's not that difficult to go and download these packages from the web and set up a small cluster and run a small volume of data through it. The real challenge comes when you're looking to handle a few billion CDRs a day, push them through a relatively small footprint of servers. Then you start getting into a lot of issues around disk access, contention between different services trying to access the network or access ports on servers, etc. And it's that kind of system engineering architecture that's required in order and understanding of that level of technology in order to be able to do this at scale. So that's kind of a lot of some of the stuff we do at the streaming. The other thing we've done, and this is actually just ironic because it ties back to one of your previous snips and the snippets and the customers, we actually also leverage a NoSQL database. And we actually leverage a NoSQL database called Accumulo, which came from the same organization that produced WannaCry. And, you know, it's a really good piece of code that they open sourced about 4 or 5 years ago, extremely scalable, highly performant, has a lot of good features that allows you to be able to both read and write data. And, you know, I would say the key feature is it allows you to find that needle in the haystack in a very real-time manner if you know how to leverage the features that they made available within that NoSQL. So it's basically understanding technology like that and figuring out how to write an application on top of it that, you know, I think leverages the strengths of the different components. And also you got to know how to avoid some of the landmines that exist if you're trying to run data at scale across these components.
I want to go ahead and bring my co-host back into this discussion because I've been watching them in the little preview monitor as they've sort of been chomping at the bit. Chibert, this is one of the promises of big data that we thought was going to be right around the corner 5 years ago. We've seen some very interesting applications of big data. We've had guests on this show that have shown us what they could do with buying patterns or what they could do with election data, population data. We don't often get companies that try to provide real-time analytics on such a large data set. But I mean, this is coming, right? I mean, the big data wars can't be too far behind.
Yeah, I'd actually like to take a small flight of fantasy with Parig and ask him, hey, you've seen all this stuff that's been going on with people defrauding this, using the Swift network to go and harvest cash out of ATM machines. If you were to fantasize about this, is this the type of thing that Argyle could possibly use machine learning for?
I think it is, yeah. I think the challenge with the financial industry is interesting because once you get into the innards of a lot of the financial companies, they have a lot of different protocols, not necessarily as many standards running across the systems as you might see in the telco and the mobile world. So I think that does introduce another level of complexity in coming up with a solution. But I think the underlying architecture is the same. It's the ability to take in the different data sets, either the Swift information and all the other protocols that are data sets that might exist within the financial services. And I think really what you got to do is you got to push it through what we call anomalous detection. So anomaly detection is kind of at the heart of a lot of the fraud detection that we do, particularly around network services, when people are basically abusing the voice and data services that they've acquired from carriers. And I do believe that the same approach will work for the type of use case you expressed around the how people hacked into Swift. And, you know, I mean, you should be able to detect with this type of technology the movement of data in a way that's not really consistent with what you would have expected. And I think the challenge that they have, which I think, you know, that's the beauty about working initially in the telco space, is that you really have to be able to deal with big data. You've got to be able to figure out how to find the fraud, which is, you know, 2-5% of all the activity across voice and data. And it's the ability to pull out the needle in the haystack and finding technologies that can do that. And once you can accomplish that in the telco world, I think it sets you up to be able to do that in other areas such as financial services, where the data sets, while they're large, I don't think they're quite as large as what you see running across the biggest mobile carriers in the world.
Let's talk about that, because Argyle Data has done an incredible job with setting up a solution for telcos, carriers, wireless companies. That much is obvious. And yes, that experience does translate over to other big data applications, but how easy would it be to move from a telco-centered solution to a financial system-centered solution? Because they're not measuring the same things and they're not looking for the same sort of activity.
So I think there are there's really two things you need to overcome or two nuts to crack. One is actually from a business perspective. Obviously, it's a different channel, different cast of characters that you need to basically establish relationships with and then understand how to sell, how to be successful in that vertical. So I think there's a whole business aspect which we'll set aside. On the technical side of things, the challenge becomes when you leverage machine learning such as we do, machine learning, it's not magic. At the end of the day, it's a series of algorithms. And at the end of the day, it's a series of algorithms that people are implementing and programming. And they're doing that with a combination of obviously the algorithmic folks with their data science background, but they're actually leveraging a lot of domain expertise that we have also in the company around understanding carriers' networks, understanding the protocol, understanding the use cases that exist within fraud. And, you know, it's that interesting combination of domain expertise, big data expertise, and machine learning expertise. Is by bringing all those together in one place, it's what has allowed us to build this application and be successful. So if you want to do the same thing in the financial services, you will also need to bring, I think, the domain expertise into the group and basically marry that up with the data science and machine learning folks. And then from that, I think marriage, you will actually find the solution for some of the problems we just talked about.
See, I like that. That's an honest answer. It is, look, we've got a solution. We've got a technology. It works well. But our data scientists can't do anything unless you actually tell us what you're looking for. And that has been an issue with some big data vendors who say, no, you just buy our solution and it will work and you'll be rich. That's not how it works.
It's not how it works. You're correct. You know, you need the domain expertise. I think the key with a good solution is that over time, and we see that ourselves. I mean, I was just talking to one of the folks who we leverage for that domain expertise. And what you're doing is you're taking the knowledge and you are automating it. And it does cut to some of the issues that are in the media and discussed quite a lot in the media at the moment around some of the potential pitfalls of machine learning. However, speaking to the same analyst, I mean, the interesting thing from their perspective is that it now frees them up to do a lot more interesting research on what's happening within the carrier's network. It also allows them to help carriers understand how to bring this technology, not just for fraud, but for other use cases in the carrier domain. And I think it's actually opening up, it's actually improving the type of job that that domain expert gets to do. It makes it more interesting. We've taken away a lot of the manual, the drudgery work that they had as a day-to-day basis prior to this. So, but yes, you need those skill sets to be brought together in order, I think, to be successful and have a good product in this space.
Well, folks, you've done it again. You've used up another hour listening to the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. That's according to 9 out of 10 data scientists. I do want to thank everyone who makes the show possible, starting with, of course, Parig Stapleton. He is the VP of Engineering at Argyle Data. Parig, this was absolutely fascinating. I love when a guest can come on and give us concrete examples of how the solution works and what would be the use case going into the future. Could you please tell the folks who are watching or listening to the show where they can find you, where they can find Argyle Data, and perhaps any last parting words of wisdom about what they should be looking for when they shop around for big data analytics?
Thanks very much, first of all, for having me on. So yeah, I can be found at Argyle Data. I'm on LinkedIn as well. If you just enter my name in Argyle Data, I think you'll find me. Wisdom. I think my parting wisdom is that we're entering, I do think, a really interesting next phase in technology. I think we will do a lot of good with machine learning. I think it will solve a lot of problems that have been, I think, outside of our grasp from the previous technology we had at our available. But it's not going to be easy. I think it's going to be a long haul. It's not going to be a straight trajectory, straight moonshot. We'll make mistakes, but I think we're looking back 10 years from now, this type of technology is going to, make a big difference, not just in the mobile space we're in or in finance, but I think across the board, actually. And I think machine learning, AI, is going to be the at the heart of it.
Parig Stapleton, thank you for joining us. And again, we thank you for the knowledge that you've given to the Twilight Riot. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Of course, we also need to thank my co-hosts. These are the men without whom I could not do this show, starting with Mr. Lou Maresca. Oh, I'm sorry. The engineer formerly known as Lou. Lou, could you please tell the folks at home where they can find you, where they can find your work, and when will you be able to talk about the super secret thing that's not actually real until you talk about it because it's super secret?
So definitely potentially next week when we announce it and I make my move and all the fun stuff coming along with it. So for right now, you can find my work at crm.dynamics.com. And of course, you can always find me on Twitter at LouMM. But in a couple weeks, you might find me somewhere else.
It's Lou Maresca, folks, the IT man of mystery. Also, Cheebert. Now, we wouldn't have the show without you because you're not just a co-host. You're not just my friend of over a decade. You're also the man who finds us the wonderful guests for This Week in Enterprise Tech. Could you tell the audience what you're going to be working on and maybe where they could find your work?
Actually, Kurt Frankman and I are desperately trying to put the finishing touches on our cloud security book. Our deadline is July 1st, and it looks like we're going to make it. Anyway, you can find me on Twitter as ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab, and be more than happy to hear from you. Thank you to Mary McAvoy, my wonderful PR rep friend that helped me find some of these great contacts. It's been a long haul, and oh, by the way, I'm actually considering retiring soon. I'm 55, and I'm going to be hitting the magic 30 years of service very soon.
Yeah, that's full pension, Cheebert, so you could retire. Although, wait, if you live on Hawaii, where do you retire to? Because most people want to retire to Hawaii.
Actually, we're taking a very, very hard look at retiring to Orlando. So we'll actually be in the same city as Kurt Franklin, within a half a decade or so.
I don't know about that. I cry shenanigans. Well, Cheaper. Now my TD is on it. Go figure. Well, Cheebert, Lou, thank you so very much. Again, it's always so much fun when you're here. And, of course, we need to thank you, the person who drops in every single week. Without you, we don't have a show. We do want to make it easier for you to get our episodes by going to our show page at twit.tv/twiet. If you go there, not only will you be able to find all of our old episodes for download, but you'll also find the links for the blips and the bytes so that you could do your own research. Also, very important is the subscribe drop-down menu. Folks, this is the best way to support This Week in Enterprise Tech. If you like Twiet, if you like the analysis that we bring you, if you like the fact that we come by every week just to bring you all the goodness we can find in the enterprise world, please, please subscribe to the version of choice on your device of choice. And also, why not share Twiet with some of your friends? If you've got people who are interested in the enterprise world, if you've got coworkers who want to hear about issues that may matter to them, now is the time to make them join the Twiet ride. Let's do a big push to make us even bigger in the coming year. Also, I need to tell you that you can follow me on Twitter. Go to twitter.com/PadreSJ. If you follow me there, you'll be able to find what I'm doing both on the network and when I'm not on the network, which is doing things like creating things. I have my own little makerspace, and I do think, like, if you can guess what this is, it means that you're hip. If you think it's a time travel device, it means you're a Doctor Who fan. But again, just follow me, twitter.com/PadreSJ. Also, special thanks to everyone who makes this show possible, to Lisa and Leo, who have allowed us to continue doing This Week in Enterprise Tech for going on 5 years now, to all the engineering staff, and of course, to my fabulous technical director, Kevin. Kevin, could you turn on your mic and tell the people what it is that you do here at Twit?
I edit, I TD, and I play around with buttons and sounds and stuff. So, yeah.
Yes, and also you may
grab screenshots of your funny face.
It's important to know that Kevin actually wasn't alive during 9/11, so that gives you some relative location of his age. Go figure.
Wow, what is this?
But Kevin, no, this is the time we get to at the end of every episode where we give you a chance at redemption. You need to answer something from the show. What is the name of the database that makes Mary Jo Foley drink beer?
Paul Theroux. Theroux.com.
I'm sorry. The answer was Hadoop. Folks, every time Mary Jo Foley hears the word Hadoop, she has to take a drink. Kevin, thank you very much. We'll give you another chance next week. Until then, folks, I am Father Robert Ballister, the digital Jesuit, just reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep Twiet.